Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
It has not affected us as of yet, but it will starting tomorrow if we can't get fuel. I mean, this literally could, you know, ruin a large percentage of us.
Fishermen in Whittier are concerned after a fire burned the fuel dock. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, July 5th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Anchorage will not clear a homeless camp after a lawsuit challenged the city's ability to do so.
There's no definitive, they did this in response to our lawsuit, but the timeline itself is pretty clear.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
You know that eating fruits and vegetables supports good health, but did you also know that frozen and canned produce offers the same health benefits as fresh? It's true. Whether fresh, frozen, canned, or from the land, eating fruits and veggies can lead to a long and healthy life. So when it comes to getting the fruits and veggies you need to stay healthy, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by Snap.
An Idaho man is accused of a cold case murder in Alaska from over a decade ago. A Palmer grand jury last month indicted 36-year-old Keenan Keyes in the 2011 death of Loy Suthamavong. Keyes is charged with shooting and killing Suthamavong at the victim's home in Houston, according to the Alaska Department of Law, which announced the indictment today. A law department spokeswoman said Keyes and Suthamavong knew each other. Suthamavong was reported missing December 6, 2011, the same day his vehicle was found burning in Anchorage. According to the law department, Keyes had driven Suthamavong's body to Aklutna Lake Road, where snowshoers found it in March of 2012. The Department of Law spokeswoman did not immediately have details on what led investigators to Keyes. He's currently serving a 15-year sentence in Idaho for several convictions related to a domestic violence incident last August. A fire broke out at a fuel dock in the South Central Alaska community of Whittier on Tuesday, injuring 2 people and sinking a boat. City officials say the fire has also temporarily closed the dock, the only place in the harbor for boats to refuel. Girdwood Fire Chief Michelle Weston says her department was called at noon to assist with the fire, joining fire departments from the city of Whittier as well as the Anton Anderson Memorial Tunnel Fire Department. Medics evaluated 2 people who were then taken by a medical evacuation service.
We had a medic unit on scene, but we also called for LifeMed to transport 2 patients.
Firefighters extinguished the blaze by Tuesday evening. The cause of the fire remains unknown. Meanwhile, the dock's closure has raised concerns for charter and commercial fishing fleets during the busy summer season. Jody Mason is owner of Alaskan Four Star Charters. She says the fire prompted Shoreside Petroleum to reopen its land-based fueling station, and people can fuel their boats by bringing them by trailer. But that's not a solution for everyone.
For those of us that have boats that are not trailerable, they are working on getting a fuel truck there that can pump both diesel and gasoline simultaneously. And as of yet, the location for that has not been determined.
Mason says a prolonged closure of the refueling dock will have major impacts on charter companies.
We've been shut down on Tuesdays and Wednesdays for halibut issues. So it has not affected us as of yet, but it will starting tomorrow if we can't get fuel. I mean, this literally could, ruin a large percentage of us.
Whittier Harbor Master David Borg also told the Anchorage Daily News he has concerns about what the closure would mean for the city's commercial fishing fleet, expected to return between tomorrow and Saturday. More than a year after Cook Inlet's largest oil and gas producer warned of a looming natural gas shortfall, consultants have released a report detailing possible ways to fill in the gap by importing gas from overseas in the short term and from the North Slope in the longer term. As KDLL Sabine Pooks reports, those options will all come with higher price tags, but with contracts running out, utilities don't have much choice.
Lisa Wilcox presented the report to the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. She's a project manager with Berkeley Research Group. She says she's not as concerned about the long-term picture for utilities, since she thinks Alaska could import liquefied natural gas at a reasonable price from the world market.
But it's short to medium term that I think we're all concerned about.
The gas supply report was commissioned by natural gas utility NSTAR and a working group of Alaska utilities from Homer to Fairbanks, which get the vast majority of their power supply from Cook Inlet natural gas. But that available supply is running out. Last year, the primary producer, Hillcorp, said it couldn't guarantee future contracts with utilities. And now, despite decades of warning and previous close calls, demand for gas could outstrip supply in as few as 4 years. Wilcox says utilities will need to find new sources of gas from a mix of places. She says the first option would be to attract more investment in Cook Inlet, but with little interest there from producers, that option likely can't satisfy long-term needs. Another preferred alternative outlined in the report is to import natural gas from overseas. That could start as soon as 2028. And another would be to bring gas down from the North Slope with an in-state pipeline, which the report says would only be cost-effective with state subsidies. That pipeline wouldn't be ready until 2030 at the earliest, the report says. In all cases, costs will go up for Alaska ratepayers, who already see some of the highest energy costs in the country. The in-state pipeline could more than double gas costs for consumers.
Well, and unfortunately, in this case, as you can see, the cost of transportation for this level of demand on a privately owned project and privately modeled project is very significant and higher than many of the other options.
The cheapest gas option outlined in the report would come from the big Alaska Liquefied Natural Gas Export Project, which would ship gas down from the North Slope for use in state and export overseas. AK LNG has been decades in the making and has long stalled due to high costs. Wilcox, the consultant, was formerly a vice president of the company that's overseeing the project. Ben Becker is with the Alaska Public Interest Research Group. He says he worries about the state committing to big projects like a pipeline.
And if the state is going to be subsidizing energy, I think it makes less sense to subsidize projects that prolong our dependence on gas instead of energy projects that make us less dependent on gas, more energy independent with a more diverse grid.
The report accounts for alternative gas supply options only. As a natural gas utility, NSTAR doesn't have many more options to diversify its portfolio. But renewables advocates say electric utilities need to start ramping up their renewable portfolios as solar and wind projects become cost competitive with natural gas. Becker says he wants to see more analysis of how renewables could reduce Alaska's demand for gas in the future.
There are long-term solutions that would really double down on our gas dependence and others that would reduce it.
The report was the first from the consulting group. Wilcox says the next report will hone in on a shorter list of local gas replacement options. She says a decision on at least one alternative could be made by the end of 2023. In Kenai, I'm Sabine Pooks.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, familiar faces win Alaska's oldest mountain race despite muddy conditions.
It's probably the gnarliest I've ever seen. Just like super muddy down in the woods and then even up top.
That is ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska needs more quality, licensed childcare providers. If you're interested in starting a childcare business, connect with threadalaska.org for support and guidance. There are several resources to get licensed and launched in Alaska. A licensed facility opens doors and opportunities for the business owner and creates a safer, more engaged place for children. You can make a lasting difference in the lives of children and their families. This message sponsored by Thread.
The homeless campers using public land next to Joint Base Almendorf-Richardson in Anchorage's Mountain View neighborhood can stay put. The city posted notices in the area on June 22nd that said the campers would have to clear out this week or face trespassing charges and have their belongings confiscated or trashed. But in a court filing Monday, the head of the city's legal department says the city no longer intends to clear the camps. The statements are in court because the American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska filed appeals on behalf of 13 campers. They were challenging the legality of the city's right to clear the camps without shelter space available for the campers. The city says those appeals are now moot. ACLU spokesperson Megan Barker says the appeals put pressure on the city to reverse course.
There's no like definitive, they did this in response to our lawsuit, but the timeline itself is pretty clear. And it's not like the city is putting forward any other options for dealing with homeless camps right now.
The city's explanation in the court filing boils down to a communications issue. The city says it thought the Department of Defense would want the camps cleared, in part out of national security concerns. But in the court filing, the city says it doesn't actually know what the military's position is on the camps and has not been able to connect with the right person because of the 4th of July holiday. Last year, Wrangell kicked off a unique partnership with the state government to split funding for a children's social worker to be based on the island. But after just over a year, the local borough administration isn't happy with the deal anymore. As KSDK's Sage Smiley reports, Wrangell's assembly cut the position's funding from its annual budget, saying it's no longer willing to pay half.
The community of Wrangell petitioned Alaska's government for years to bring back a children's welfare worker to the island. Last year, they worked out a deal. The state and Wrangell would each pay for half. The arrangement was the first of its kind in the state. But just over a year later, local government officials say they feel the community isn't getting their fair share of the position's time or resources. Here's Borough Manager Jeff Good.
We're paying half the bill for the position, which, you know, it's great to have someone here locally, and she does a great job here locally. The problem is it's not half the time spent here in Wrangell. It's probably maybe 25% or even less on the cases here locally, but we're spending, you know, paying for half of it and providing facilities for that position as well.
The position is with the State Office of Children's Services, or OCS, the understaffed agency tasked with protecting minors from unsafe and abusive situations. At a budget workshop in early June, Police Chief Tom Radke said he didn't think the setup was a fair one.
You know, we're the only city in Alaska that's paying that $53,000.
Okay. I don't see why we as a city have to pay for that. For even half of it.
Nobody else pays for even half.
Nobody pays. We're paying 50% of the OCS position.
And you know why. Because that was the deal we made with Representative Ortiz to try to get OCS service here.
That was Radke discussing with Assemblymember Dave Powell and Mayor Patty Gilbert. The OCS funding was part of Radke's department budget. The office space for the worker sits in a corner of the public safety building.
She has to go to Prince of Wales, let's say, for a week, and they have stuff over there. Okay, Wrangell's paying 50% of her wage. Well, it's over in Prince of Wales. It's not here. And I'm very sympathetic, but it's just... this just didn't work out. We said we'd try it for a year. We've tried it. And I think if the state wants to cover that, then let the state cover it. We're the only city in Alaska that's doing it.
Okay, so I want to make, is it OCS? Is that what it's
yes.
called?
Uh-huh.
I want to make a motion to pull the OCS out of our budget.
At the borough's annual budget adoption, Assemblymember Dave Powell offered a solution, and Wrangell's elected leaders unanimously agreed to cut the position's funding. But it may not be the total end of the OCS position in Wrangell. Borough Manager Good says he's been in talks with the state, and they're willing to work out a deal.
I followed up with the Office of Children's Services, and they did get back to me. And what they're offering is that we would only pay $25,000 versus the $53,000. So I can bring that back before the assembly for a budget amendment. Or I could eliminate it.
OCS has not responded to requests for comment on the situation. With the local funding cut for now, though, it's not immediately clear whether the state's half will cover continued services while Wrangell's government tries to finalize what they feel is a better deal. In the meantime, Mayor Gilbert directed the borough manager to bring back a quarter funding proposal at the borough assembly's next meeting. In Wrangell, I'm Sage Smiley.
Unalaska is preparing to start monitoring for European green crab. That's after the invasive species was first found in Alaska last July. KUCB's Hope McKinney has more.
Biologists with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game say the monitoring program is crucial in the nation's largest fishing port and are preparing to deploy traps later this summer.
We don't have any reason to believe that European green crab are here or established in the region, but we're also not currently doing any monitoring.
Ethan Nichols is the assistant area manager for shellfish with Fish and Game in Dutch Harbor.
With European green crab steadily moving up the west coast, you know, through British Columbia and into southern southeast Alaska as of last year, I think it's important that we start monitoring here in the port of Dutch Harbor, specifically just given the amount of international ship traffic that we have. So lots of cargo and fishing boats transiting from the west coast of the United States, as well as international traffic going to Asia and back and forth.
In much of the state, scientists have been looking for the crabs for years. In communities around Kachemak Bay and Prince William Sound, they've been setting traps for about two decades. Tammy Davis is the invasive species program coordinator with Fish and Game in Juneau. She says European green crab, which are native to coastal Europe and North Africa, are so concerning because although they're small, they're incredibly aggressive. They reduce eelgrass and populations of clams, oysters, mollusks, and other invertebrates that live on or in the seafloor. They can also prey on juvenile native crabs like Dungeness, something that could impact Aleutian Island fisheries down the line if their habitats overlap.
Green crab are considered, you know, one of the top 100 invasive species globally.
Like anywhere else, Davis says, they would have impacts on the nearshore environment, and organisms that rely on that intertidal and subtidal habitat would be at risk.
They behave differently in different environments. You know, there's, of course, some sort of general parameters of temperature triggers for reproduction and tolerance for temperatures and so forth. But they're very hardy organisms, these crabs. And so we don't know what the potential impacts are in an environment like Dutch Harbor at this point.
Davis says biologists are concerned that green crab could be introduced into Dutch Harbor through ballast water discharge or by currents carrying larvae out the Aleutian chain. She says they hope to identify coastal areas with high-value commercial, recreational, and subsistence harvests and use intensive trapping as a way to monitor and control green crab populations as they start to spread across the state. She says setting traps also helps them understand what species use these areas and are at risk of green crab predation.
Whatever ends up in our traps also uses this part of the near shore. Those are the species that are at risk from green crab.
Davis says although it's not likely they'll be able to get rid of green crab if they establish themselves in the Aleutians, early detection is crucial.
So you're keeping the population of green crab low enough that the negative impact they have on the native species and the native habitat is not greater than the native species can handle.
Fish and Game plans to launch the monitoring program in the port of Dutch Harbor this summer. Five traps are on their way to the island now. If you find what you think might be a European green crab, call Fish and Game's invasive species hotline at 1-877-INVASIVE or visit their website. Reporting in on Alaska, I'm Hope McKenney.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing cargo transportation to 9 Alaska communities. NAC offers options including cargo charters to get freight where it needs to be. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. The IBEW is the union of skilled hands and generous hearts, hardworking people on the job and off. It's the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, the IBEW. This message sponsored by the IBEW Local 1547.
Support for public radio comes from the communities we serve. Whether you give as an individual member or through your business, know that your contribution makes possible programming that informs, inspires, and entertains. We thank you for the role you play in your public radio station.
More than 800 runners tackled Seward's grueling Mount Marathon race yesterday, despite rain, mud, and treacherous conditions. As Alaska Public Media's Dev Hardiker reports, many said this year's race was the toughest one yet.
The crowd erupts as David Norris crosses the finish line, winning Seward's Mount Marathon men's race in 44 minutes and 51 seconds. He's panting, grinning, and covered head to toe in mud. He says it was the toughest race he's ever run.
It's probably the gnarliest I've ever seen. Just like super muddy down in the woods. And then even up top where it's usually just like dry rock, even that had like a little mud mixed in.
This is Norris's fourth time running Mount Marathon and his fourth win. He's originally from Fairbanks and currently lives in Colorado. He set the Mount Marathon record in 2016. And while he didn't beat that time this year, he did win with a substantial 1 minute and 44 second lead over his closest competitor, Nevada's Darren Thomas. Both Norris and Thomas, and all the runners, were met by race staff wielding hoses at the finish line.
There it is.
Who sprayed them with water to help clean off all the mud. This year marked the 95th running of the race that sends competitors up and back down the towering Mount Marathon every 4th of July. The course is 3.1 miles long with an elevation gain of just under 3,000 feet. It's a steep uphill scramble and a furious downhill plummet. It usually takes top runners 35 to 40 minutes to reach the peak, and only 10 to 15 minutes to come hurtling back down. From the street, the runners look like tiny, brightly colored dots on the mountainside. People watch from the finish line with binoculars, taking occasional breaks to hit up the many food trucks. Between the women's and men's races, a 4th of July parade makes its way down the street to the finish line. People on floats toss candy to the sea of wet spectators. In the women's race, Christy Marvin of Palmer came out on top with a time of 52 minutes and 52 seconds. The crowd went wild as she pulled off a close first place just 15 seconds ahead of runner-up Meg Inokuma of Palmer, who she embraced right after she crossed the finish line.
This is my 10th year, and it was my goal to make it in the top three all 10 years in a row. And I did it today with a third win, so I'm super stoked.
Marvin says the rain made the race especially tough this year. It slowed down all the runners, who had to be careful not to slip in the hazardous mud.
The conditions were an absolute nightmare and a huge mess, and I was really nervous, both for my boys this morning and then for myself this afternoon.
Marvin wasn't the only one in her family with a first-place win at this year's Mount Marathon. Her 16-year-old son Kobe won the boys' race. 15-year-old Tanya Boonstra of Kenai won the girls' race. Despite the intense conditions, spirits were high all day, with some runners dashing up and down the mountain in full costume. Competitors and their families celebrated together at the finish line, and the DJ blasted Rihanna's Umbrella as the rain poured down. In Anchorage, I'm Dev Hardiker.
Last weekend, friends and family of Donald Sompi Elliott gathered in Bethel to celebrate his life. The Korean War veteran died in May. He was 88 years old. Five of his children were in town to remember their father, and KYUK's Francisco Martinez Cuello brings us this audio postcard of their memories of him.
Donald Eugene Elliott was born on December 24, 1934, in his hometown of Florence, Arizona.
Sunday Hondel. Well, my dad, Sompi, was a wonderful dad. I got to share his birthday. All my life, I got to be his first daughter, so I adored and loved that man very much. He set groundwork for all of us to be hardworking people in our life and not to just take things, you know, for granted. He was very compassionate, and he was a great leader in our family. Him and my mom set a great example for us growing up.
My name is Glenn Elliott. I am the second of six. I had an older brother named Scott who had died in a airplane accident. My dad, he grew up without a father. He did not have a father figure in his life. So I think that made him the best father to me and to this community. He was a surrogate father to a lot of people, and I think when you don't have something, you know what you're missing, and he made up for it by, you know, being a Boy Scout master and, you know, being a kind of a father figure to like soldiers returning home from foreign wars.
It's Rebecca Malloy. Dad was really, really special to all of us. He, I just remember growing up, and he was always very hands-on. We lived in a little one-bedroom house, and then he built our big house. Dad was that he was like that, like he really built this Bethel community.
Jill Hoffman. We are here today to celebrate my dad's service. He passed away in May, and he was a lifelong member of the VFW. He helped build Bethel to what it is today, and we are honoring and celebrating his life today. You know, but I just want to talk about, you know, his contribution to Bethel, to this VFW post. He was one of the three charter members to get it built, and he was just one of the proudest veterans around.
Anna Bach.
Okay, well, I'm the youngest of Sompi's children, and he's just, I think, a bit of a legend and an inspiring community member that really just, I think, set the standard pretty high in terms of service to country and service to community and a genuine love of family and loyalty and friendship. It's really special to come and have his burial service here in Bethel on the cusp of the 4th of July weekend. He would, anytime he was here in Bethel for the summer for the annual 4th of July parade, he was perhaps one of the most patriotic people, which I think is just really important, you know, for sake of our freedoms. And it's sentimental to be here at the Robert V. Lindsay post 10,041 because he's the last living charter member.
That was Francisco Martinez Coelho reporting from Bethel. And finally tonight, a correction to a story Monday about Housing Alaskans, a public-private partnership, or HAP. We reported the cost of housing in rural Alaska is $9 per square foot. It's actually $900 per square foot. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Chris Clint, Wesley Early, and Jeremy Shea in Anchorage, Sabine Pooks in Kenai, Sage Smiley in Wrangell, Hope McKinney in Unalaska, Dev Hardiker in Seward, and Francisco Martinez Coelho in Bethel. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Would you like to play a part in the public media you enjoy? Consider becoming a member or corporate sponsor. Contact your public radio station to learn how. From one end of Alaska to the other and everywhere in between, public media works to provide quality programming and statewide news you can count on and news you can trust. Whether you're listening at home, at work, or in the car, we're grateful to be a part of your day. Thank you for tuning in. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.